this seminar's been put together by your great friends in the corporate team, basically Dan, and I approved it and went through it with him. But it's supposed to be a really simple guide as to what we do when, as we see more and more, you get clients saying, I'm buying the property through a limited company. Now, commercial obviously always send it over to us, but before we never had a separate team that did anything corporate-wise in terms of what you were buying as a residential property. And it's really important that I hope that you guys realise that actually we get a lot of flack from the clients, as do you, saying, oh, it's taking too long. Why is it costing more? What's the hold up? But there are specific company law related things that we all need to be aware of that impact on the conveyancing transaction as a whole. Not the conveyancing process, because what you guys do stays the same primarily, but the additional company law aspects are things that you guys, I hope you take something out of this and go, oh, they don't just tick a couple of boxes, there is actually stuff that they have to do. So, right, so the seminar's on buying property through a corporate vehicle. Oh, looks a lot bigger on the computer screen. Right, so why is this important? Just running through the reasons. It's not a normal purchase by individuals, but a corporate entity. Corporate entity is a separate living, breathing entity in its own right. So you have to bear that in mind. Even an individual is alive, like all of us are at the moment, a company is alive as well. And a company has its obligations legally and it can contract with third parties. So the company and the people are separate things. Why is this important? Well, the government changed the rules on interest on mortgage payments for individuals. It's not tax deductible anymore in their annual return. But companies borrowing money can deduct the interest payable on their loans against their corporation tax. So this is the fundamental reason why the last 2 or 3 years we've seen such a rise in people buying property through corporate entities. So individuals are being encouraged primarily to buy as a company by IFAs and mortgage brokers, and this is primarily to you guys if you're watching this seminar, which we'll be sending it to you all individually, but they're not told the legal requirements at that stage. And why would you? You're not legally trained, it's not your job. It's a good idea to buy through a limited company, particularly if you're going to try building a portfolio, but obviously there are requirements that, you know, hopefully you'll take something from this as well. Banks don't just lend to anybody, as we all know. Banks are very, very cautious at the moment, particularly post-COVID-19. They ask for guarantees. That requires independent legal advice, as you know, which is a pain in the backside. Loan agreements, evidence of deposits not being gifts but as loans to ensure their charge isn't at risk. And we'll touch on that later in deposits being gifts to companies. Banks require all the company law requirements to be complied with by us. When we sign that certificate of title, it means we've done the conveyancing process, but we've also checked all the points and all the conditions on the mortgage relevant to the company law aspects. So you have to remember when you're telling the client that we can't exchange because we haven't got this, this and this from you, it's because we have to sign that certificate of title and the company law requirements also need to be complied with. Banks are now, in this current market, some of you might have seen, I think this week, Nationwide are effectively closing the door on the bank of mum and dad by requiring only a certain percentage of the purchase price being provided by third party gifts. So banks are becoming more pessimistic in lending and they're requiring strict criteria and conditions on all lending. That's going to impact on companies buying at some point as well. They're going to have more onerous conditions. Mortgages are therefore harder to obtain and legal requirements are becoming more onerous. Most importantly, and this is the one that we all get, and you've all been there, clients don't tell you all the information at the start, and they certainly sometimes don't even tell you they're buying as a limited company when you give them the estimate, and only halfway through or 2 weeks in, they go, oh, by the way, I'm buying as Dave and Andrew, mates for life, limited. But they've not told you that at the start, and you're ending up, then you have to explain to them why there's a difference. And the reason is there's more work for the solicitor or the conveyancer, and not necessarily made clear to the client when they think it's a simple conveyancing transaction. So the conveyancing process, what changes? Well, nothing actually changes in the actual property side of things. You're still buying bricks and mortar. The legal process for the client and lender to buy the property are exactly the same. And we still do, but it's not limited to, as you all know, the title report, searches and searches report. You raise inquiries. Full report for the client at the end. You send certificate title to the bank to release funds. All the other processes and requirements are the same. Like you check the lease, you make sure the lease doesn't have onerous provisions for the bank. So what you guys do as conveyancers doesn't change. You're doing the same thing. So what is different when buying as a company? So primarily, the lender requirements when lending to a company are, the main difference is the company's legal entity, as I said earlier, is a living, breathing, separate entity, and it has its own legal obligations that individuals will not. The bank requires us to ensure that those legal obligations of the company are complied with. each lender is different. And when you get the mortgage offer, actually, you'll see this. So let's say we've got Santander, or let's say we've got NatWest, or let's say we've got a mainstream lender. At the back of the conditions, when we get the mortgage offer through from you guys, there's a separate section that actually says company document requirements, company requirements. So we tick through that, and there's usually about 7 or 8. I think, Vic, we've done a few where, you know, we tick through them, and it's just literally checking stuff. So those lists include, but again, not limited to, and it all depends on the lender, copies of the company's constitution being checked. That's the articles, any private shareholders agreements, unlikely. A lot of the times, it's very unlikely you're going to get a newly incorporated company coming to you from the accountant and IFA who recommended buying through a limited company and they've got a shareholders agreement. I would be flabbergasted if that happens 1 in 100,000 times. So we need to check what are the articles, why we look at them. Confirmation that the company has authority to buy and sell property and to borrow money and register charge at company's house. Now, in the constitution, the documentation that allows the company to do things, it may not be clear that they are actually allowed to buy property, something we have to check, and we'll come on to that in a minute as to why that's important. Confirmation that where the deposit is not being provided by way of a loan, such a loan ranks behind the mortgagee's charge. Now, how many times do you get a client saying to you, yeah, we're gifting the deposit to the company? Okay, it's something for some reason IFAs are telling clients that we're gifting the deposit to the company. Now, often actually the loan is not documented and is not a gift, but the bank in their mortgage offer require any loan second to theirs to be documented as a loan document, a loan agreement. It's becoming more prevalent now that the lenders are saying, if there is third party lending money to the company for the deposit or any part of the purchase, we require that to be documented in a loan agreement. So that's becoming more prevalent because they want everything to be correct so it doesn't affect their primary charge, their first charge. So we need to also check that the company is not subject to any other charge or mortgage, that the directors guarantee the loan to the company. That's obviously their personal guarantee that they're giving. For that, we need to give them independent legal advice, or another firm needs to give them independent legal advice for that guarantee. We need a copy of the resolution or resolutions. There could be shareholder resolutions required or board resolutions authorizing the company to enter into the mortgage deed and the purchase, or even shareholder resolutions when we have to authorize certain actions by the shareholders, which we'll touch on in a minute. Then there's obviously the requirement to have a proper registration of charge at company's house with strict deadlines, as you know. So I'm going to repeat this again. We have a duty to act for the lender, and therefore we are unable to act for a company if we cannot confirm the points required above at a minimum. Some of them have more onerous requirements as well on top of what we've just put there in the certificate of title. There's one thing actually we've left off that we need to put. We also need to do a check that the company isn't insolvent immediately before completion, which in our checklist that we have for the company purchasing, you do it on info tracking as we do, and the conveyancer does that. It's a high court search. So next slide. Right, company constitution, what and why? So a company is governed by its articles of association, or just known as the articles. There are model articles of association, which basically when you incorporate a company at company's house, you tick a box and it says, are you going to incorporate with the model articles of association? You say yes, and it's all done for you. Most companies coming off the shelf will always have what's known as the model articles of association. There's been many over the years, but the current one, it covers quite a lot of ground and they change every now and again. So those articles of association, most companies have exactly the same ones. Our job in corporate often is that we get clients that are coming to us with much more complicated transactions, much more complicated companies, and we may amend those articles specifically to their needs. So what is important to note here? So the first one we touched on earlier, can the company actually purchase the property? Now, previously to the 2006 Companies Act, companies used to have a memorandum of association, and the memorandum of association was part of the constitutional documents, and the memorandum would have what's known as an objects clause, and an objects clause would say, for example, this company has been incorporated for the sole purpose of buying, making and selling widgets, let's say, for example. Okay, now that objects clause would only permit the company to do what was in the object. So unless it said buying and selling property, it cannot buy and sell property. So it would act ultra vires, which means outside of its legal jurisdiction, outside of its regulations. So the company can't do that. So we have to check if it's an old incorporated company and they're buying a property, although it doesn't happen all the time, usually they're newly incorporated and each property this person buys in their portfolio is in a different company. But we need to check that. Why is that important? Well, actually, if a company has acted ultra vires and purchased a property and entered into a loan agreement for the purchase of that property, the bank's charge is actually outside the legal jurisdiction of the company. So let's say if there was a creditor chasing the company, they can set aside the bank's charge. So they can say, you couldn't have entered into that purchase of the property and you couldn't have entered into that charge. So that is now outside of any security. The bank's charge is no longer secured. Therefore, the creditor can go after the property without having to pay the mortgage off. So that is why that's important. And obviously, if that happens, then the IFA, the mortgage broker, and us would be negligent. And the client's going to, and the bank's going to come looking straight at you for why you didn't check that. So that's why we check that point. That's not a problem now for newly incorporated companies, because modified articles of association are now fine because they don't have an objects clause. But we still need to check, because some people specifically put objects clause even though they're not supposed to, or they when they incorporate, or it's incorporated incorrectly. So we need to check that. So the second thing that we have is, can the company actually vote the resolution at board level to approve the mortgage and the purchase? So the bank require in their conditions a board resolution signed by the chairman and carried out by the company's directors approving the purchase and the mortgage. They need that paperwork because it's a legal requirement for any company to have board resolutions to approve things that they're doing, because the board and the directors run the company on a day-to-day basis for the benefit of the shareholders, which most of the time is themselves anyway. So the point here is, do they have quorum? Quorum is effectively the requirement for the number of directors that are eligible to vote and are present to be able to vote. Now, if it's a one director, one shareholder kind of operation, there is actually Article 7.2 in the Modern Articles, which allows that one person to make decisions on behalf of the company. But legally, every company incorporated with Modern Articles Association needs two eligible directors to be able to vote. And when I went back to Dave and Andrew, Best Mates for Life Limited, Dave and Andrew will both be, in that example, directors, and they will both be shareholders. Now, why is that a problem? Because if there's a conflict between a director and a company, say, for example, they're purchasing the property with the loan, but one of the directors is going to live in the property. One of the directors is lending the deposit at a rate of interest to the company. The director is getting the contract to do the work as a developer to the property they're doing up. These could all be potential conflicts of interest with the company. That director can't vote in the board resolution to approve the purchase and the mortgage. Therefore, you don't have quorum. Therefore, you can't pass that resolution, the board resolution. So what do you do in that situation? This is where clients, and obviously IFAs and people advising people to buy in a company, they don't understand the legal implications, and again, nor should they. They're not legally trained. That's what we obviously get paid for to do. So in those situations where there's a conflict, it's a real mess. And it's a board resolution, shareholder resolution, board resolution sandwich. It's called a resolution sandwich. But basically, the director concerned with the transaction where they're conflicted can't vote unless the company by ordinary resolution disapplies the restricting provision in the articles. Now to do that, you need to call a written resolution of the shareholders. They need to wait 14 days, unless the 14-day period is disapplied by 95% of the shareholders. They need to have a board resolution to say that there's going to be a shareholder resolution, hold the shareholders meeting, then hold another board resolution. That's why it's a sandwich of a shareholders resolution. It's a real pain in the ass. The director's interest cannot reasonably be regarded as right to give a reason to a conflict. Well, there's no hard and fast rule on what is a conflict and what isn't. You don't want to be going down the river and all of a sudden someone says that was a conflict. It's, conflict of interest situation, again, we would be negligent to the bank in that sense, because actually the transaction wouldn't have been approved properly. And believe me, when there's an insolvency situation, insolvency practitioners will look at any way to unwind transactions to create funds for creditors. So you don't want that position where, oh, that looks like it could have been a conflict at the time, and we've not considered that. The director's conflict of interest arises from a permitted cause. Right, I mean, that's a bigger conversation, but basically they're permitted to do it because the conflict doesn't really create a problem for the company in that scenario. So I've explained that. So if the director is conflicted from voting, there are two of them, and a disapplication of the quorum requirements for a conflict is not removed, you'll need to do all the board resolution, shareholders resolution, etc., etc. This could take weeks. Therefore, frustration of the transaction Meanwhile, the IFA estate agent and client think this is overdoing the transaction when actually it is a legal requirement for the reasons I've explained. So we have to be on our game in respect of that. So, statutory requirements, and I put there, what, more legal requirements? Yes. On top of the constitutional check that we do, we have to comply with statutes. Of course, as you know, I don't need to explain to you guys, you know, how to suck eggs, but statutory requirements are set by statutes, such as the Companies Act 2006 or the Insolvency Act 1986, but there's so many acts that we have to obviously be aware of. These also need to be adhered to. So what are the things that we need to obviously adhere with the company? Well, a company will always require board minutes approving actions that the company enters into, and they need to actually be kept for 10 years under Section 248 of the Companies Act. So it's no good the client saying to you, and this happens quite often, where they say, I'll just draft the board minutes. My accountant will do it. Okay, that's great. Is it properly drafted? Is it correct? I mean, we can do a whole seminar on how board resolutions can be done, but let's say one of the people isn't around. You can actually do it over the telephone. So if all the directors are happy to do that, you can do it over the telephone. So you have to be aware that they have to be kept for 10 years, and the client needs to be told, by the way, keep these for 10 years. Does the transaction need shareholder approval? So aside from the change of the articles we mentioned previously, you have a situation where a substantial property transaction may arise, an SPT. An SPT is a situation where a company enters into a transaction for assets, in this instance a property, which is connected to either them or someone who is known as a connected party. And the connected party definition is massive in the Companies Act. So, you know, mum, dad, brother, sister, wife, children. It's massive, it's really long. So let's say, for example, and they don't tell you this, clients, they tell you this. We're buying this property. All right, brilliant. We're buying it as a limited company. Fantastic. They've gone through all of this, and halfway through, they go, oh, yeah, by the way, my cousin owns the property. Or, sorry, my wife owns the property, or my wife's father owns the property. You know, these things can all end up being connected persons, but obviously, we have to check whether they're connected persons under the transaction. Why is that relevant? It's because SPTs need to be properly documented, and there needs to be shareholder approval of the transaction. It creates an issue with timings in particular, because obviously the 14 days to call a shareholder's resolution, to pass the resolution to confirm the SPT, and the additional board minutes. Now, clients at the time aren't going to really know that. They're just going to think, well, we're just buying a property from someone who is connected. Obviously, they don't know that, but it adds time to the transaction. It adds cost because we've got to draft the resolutions. We've got to advise them on the SPT. We've got to cover our backs, obviously, in respect of the advice we're given, so that we're not negligent. And of course, the bank needs to approve the transaction. It's an SPT. The bank will need to know, and they'll need to give advice. So this all adds on to the length of the transaction, which of course everyone gets upset about in terms of the IFA, the estate agent, the client, the seller. But we just obviously need to be aware that if we handle this at the start and ask these questions, they don't come back to bite us during the transaction. The first statutory requirement, of course, is to register the charge at company's house within 21 days after the charge has been created. That is a very draconian deadline. If you miss that 21 days, you have to apply to the High Court for an order to be able to register out of time, and that could cost thousands of pounds. That's why the corporate team register it, because we've got an online way of doing it, and it just gets done there and then. And of course, we also need to check on the MRO one. Is it a fixed or floating charge? Who the person with the benefit of charges. Sometimes the bank might say Santander on the paperwork, but the actual person they want as the charge holder is a subsidiary of the company. So we have to check all the paperwork in that respect. Statutory resolutions, what do we draft? So board minutes do not necessarily need to ensure that every word said is recorded. It's not someone sitting there like with smoke coming off a typewriter. It's just obviously accurately record what was decided and contain a thought process that led to them being made. We have a standard precedent for that, which obviously we use and most companies use. There's a statutory procedure also for approving and requiring shareholder approval for resolutions. So, for example, a copy of the resolution must be sent to every eligible member. A copy of the resolution must be accompanied by a statement informing the members how to signify their agreement. And once the resolution has been circulated, remember it cannot be withdrawn. So those are important things in respect to what we do with the statutory resolutions. We touched on this earlier, and it's the gift or loan scenario. We always, whenever we get a recommendation from residential property, and it says, and the IFA will get in touch with them, yeah, they're gifting the deposit to the company. Now, of course, that's their choice. They can do that. But sometimes the banks do not permit that. And actually, in the paperwork, they say that anything given to the company by any third party needs to be properly documented, because what they don't want is a dispute afterwards as to how that money was given to the company for the deposit element and the element that they weren't paying for, basically. And for that to cause a scenario that would potentially adversely affect their charge. So what they want is for the second charge, effectively here, the loan given by the individual to the company, to be properly documented. If they want it to be registered at company's house, it's second to them. If they want to be registered at land registry, second to them, obviously, once it's gone to company's house as well. So government guidelines say a recommended rate of interest for these types of loans is 2.9%. Any money that anyone borrows from a private company they're involved with, it's 2.9% as well. So the loan may be registered at company's house. We haven't put must, because it's up to the client. And clients always go, no, it's all right, I don't need it registered. But the reason we insist on that is because of insolvency law. So if you're not a secured creditor and you haven't got your charge registered at company's house and at the land registry, you basically are unsecured for that loan. If you've got a gift, there's no way you're going to get that money back. That company goes pop. The bank's going to take its money, and obviously all the cost of the insolvency practitioner or receiver, whoever they appoint, is going to be taken by the bank and their fees, and then whatever's left is going to be unsecured. And in that scenario, if you haven't registered your loan, this is why we always say to clients, don't put a gift. We'll draft a loan agreement. And I think we're quite reasonable on that. We're charging £500 plus VAT to register, to draft, go through, and make sure a loan agreement is registered for the individual lending potentially £30,000, £40,000, £50,000, £60,000 to the company. So it's definitely something that we push. So this is the insolvency considerations that I was touching on earlier. We can be negligent, so could the IFA and a mortgage broker or the solicitor, if we say gift is fine. It has to ideally be a loan registered, otherwise they're unsecured. So I don't need to go over this slide in that greater detail, I've just gone over it before. So anything else? Well, independent legal advice. Lenders will lend money to companies that are buying property. They don't care necessarily where the rest of the money comes from, as long as it's properly documented and obviously all the money laundering and origin of funds checks has been done. But they will ask the directors to give guarantees. I haven't seen one recently at all that there hasn't been a guarantee requirement for the individual directors. I don't know if anyone here has. I haven't seen one. So ILA, independent legal advice. A lot of firms don't touch it. We do. We provide ILA. I think you've got to be confident in your ability to give legal advice, which is obviously what we all like to think that we are. So we give ILA, and you know, Hamish gives that, I give that, Jamie gives that, three directors here, we're happy to do that, because obviously there's standard wording, there's standard letters, and we sit down and go over the ILA with the client. But it's important, it has to be face to face. We had a situation during lockdown where we had to get bank approval to do a Zoom ILA meeting, and the bank took about 10 days to come back to us and then finally approve it, because they weren't sure whether they could, because the whole point of the meeting is that you sit down in front of them and go, here's the mortgage paperwork, these clauses you need to be ready, you know, you need to look into, etc. So we're not here to analyse the commercial viability, but to make sure that the individual understands the legal obligations under the personal guarantee. Now, I'm seeing more and more that the majority of the lenders are allowing the same firm that's doing the conveyancing and the company advice to give the ILA, but they have to be in a separate office. Some lenders are insisting that it's another firm. That's obviously their prerogative. Importantly, each guarantor will need separate advice. Now, this is a pain because it adds cost and expense and leaves the client feeling unhappy when this should have been explained at the point of purchase by the IFA or the broker and obtaining a mortgage, because ILA is very important. And it's not, you're doing the same letter for Dave that you're giving to Andrew. Each person's obligations are different. We still have to have the meeting with them. We still have to go over through everything with them. As you know, all these things take time. Finally, registering the charge at company's house, a final legal requirement. Dan's put all the details here, but as you know, 21 days, it's £23 for paper, £15 online. It's MRO1 form. We fill it out online. But importantly for you guys as conveyancers, we need the UTR, we need the VAT number, we need details from the directors, because otherwise we won't be able to do it online. and a paper, you're basically putting your finger in the air and seeing which way the wind blows, because you're sending it to Cardiff. And I've had a situation before where we've sent a paper form at a firm I worked at before. 10 days later, 11 days later, I rang them up and said, have you got this paper? We're behind by 2 weeks on our post. Right, okay, 21 days is ticking down. It doesn't, weekends count, by the way. So it's 3 weeks from the date that the charge is created. And all of a sudden you're like, right, okay, day 18, have you got this yet? No, we haven't. No, it's not been received. So we had to literally rush a courier to get them to a paper form over to Cardiff, get them to stamp for it, etc. We got there by the skin of our teeth. You're putting your finger in the air and seeing which way the wind blows with a paper form. So online is much better, but we need the UTR. You'll need it for the SDLT form anyway. But clients are very, they also have an online HMRC code to register, to log into their company details. So we need that as well. But Dan obviously always asks that from you, but it's not a surprise that Dave and Andrew, Best Mates for Life Limited, often forget this in the obviously hype of buying the property. They do need to be prodded to get that. We've got some horror stories. We've all been there. You know, the main one is constantly having to explain why this is necessary and takes time and cost. Poor Dan is getting the brunt of it. You know, it's costing me money to do this. You know, it does. And Dan's got, you know, really good character to deal with all that. That's why I let him take those calls. You know, we've had a recent horror story when the lender required board minutes, independent legal advice and loan agreement, and the client was only told about these additional requirements because he switched to buying as a company at literally almost the point of exchange, and we had to rush to get all of this stuff done. As you all know, we touched on this earlier, halfway through the transaction, clients go, we're buying as a company now. Happens all the time, but we still have to satisfy the lender's requirements, and of course, what does that do? It creates a delay in the chain. So it's managing those expectations, it's asking that question at the start. Having to explain to clients why the ILA is for each person and costs are for each person, this is like the biggest bugbear. You're doing the same thing for Dave and me. Yes, the point is, it is the same thing, but we still have to sit down with you for that half hour meeting. We still have to open a separate file, still have to draft a letter for you explaining everything. Might be the same letter, but we're reducing our cost because there's two, we get that, but it's still additional work. We just had one recently where a non-traditional lender asked for an intercreditor deed at the last minute, and the client obviously didn't know about this requirement or the IFA, and we hadn't estimated for it. So the client expected us to look at it for free, but he didn't want to pay us for the loan agreement in the first place. So he drafted his own loan agreement. He was an accountant. An intercreditor deed is a loan agreement ranking each loan in terms of their rank. So the bank wants them to enter into the other person lending money to the company to say, I guarantee that your loan is always first to mine. That's what an intercreditor deed is. So we had to, obviously, he looked at it himself in the end and signed it, but he didn't want us to look at it. But you know, these things pop up all the time. So conclusions that we can take from this. Clients need to be told at the start that buying a property for a company is it's not the same. And it's not easier than buying a property personally. They must be aware there are additional requirements and costs. We have to be open on that. We've obviously put together a cost schedule for all of you, which has been sent around by Dan about 62 million times now. But you know, if you ever need it again, please do email him. I think it's saved somewhere in Leap as well. The individual directors, shareholders and a company are separate legal entities and have to be treated as such. Each have their own duties and legal requirements that they have to adhere to, which I hope I've touched on briefly here. Even when a company has a sole director and shareholder, the company itself is a legal, breathing, living entity, and so is the individual, so you have to be aware of that. Clients shouldn't be put off benefiting from buying a property via a corporate vehicle, but they need to be given a clear picture at the start and clear costs. There are cost savings for them, obviously, in terms of claiming the interest element of their mortgage payments back against their corporation tax, but obviously there's additional cost in running a company, including accountancy fees for that company, the additional legal fees that we need to obviously charge them for the purchase, but obviously they need to take that to their own commercial viewpoint. Most important thing for us is the lender's requirements have to be satisfied correctly and in accordance with company law. So we need to send that certificate of title. And the only way we can do that is when everything, including these company aspects, have been looked at properly, professionally, done properly, and the client's all been signed off. So that's it, basically. That concludes this very short seminar on what we do. I hope you've got a better understanding of what we do. And that, you know, when the client does ask you what's the delay, what's happening, and Dan or myself or Mark says to you, SPT scenario, you're like, right, there's an substantial property transaction. These slides are available. We'll send them to you as well afterwards. If you've got any questions, let us know. Yeah, thanks for coming. Yeah, really good to have you.
Hello, you lovely people. Just to note that this is a podcast and does not constitute legal advice. Should you require any specific legal advice based on anything, then please contact your solicitor, or even better, us, and we can advise you fully.